the idea that a person, right, can't be both LGBTQ and religious, that's a false construction.
From Interfaith Alliance, this is The State of Belief. I'm Interfaith Alliance President Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch in New York City.
It's a political construction, largely, right? It's something that was sort of created to fuel political division.
There's a reason we use the tagline, "Where religion and democracy meet," for The State of Belief. Religious beliefs and affiliation play a very powerful role in the political views and behaviors of most Americans. A fascinating analysis of the intersection of religious and political beliefs has recently been published in the form of a book, Yes, God, How Faith Shapes LGBT Identity and Politics in the United States. And I'm looking forward to getting to know the author, R.G. Cravens, on this week's show. As we keep growing our library of extraordinary interviews, I want to make sure that you are subscribed to the State of Belief podcast. Please visit stateofbelief.com/subscribe. You'll hear this episode in full, as well as recent interviews with Dr. Jamar Tisby, Rabbi Sharon Brous, Bishop William Barber, Dr. Anathea Butler, and Rob Reiner and Dan Partlin talking about their documentary, God and Country. It would really help us to have you subscribe, rate, and tell the people you're close to about all that you're hearing. The State of Belief is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation, thank you for helping get these conversations heard by more people who need them. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how to do that is available at stateofbelief.com, and you can find out more about the work of Interfaith Alliance and join us at interfaithalliance.org. And now to my guest. Dr. Royal G. Cravens III is Senior Research Analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center. The author of several incredibly important recent reports, R.G. has also just released a new book titled Yes, God, spelled G-A-W-D, How Faith Shapes LGBT Identity and Politics in the United States. This is a topic that has gotten much less attention than it deserves, with the framing far too often being people of faith on one side and secular LGBTQI Americans on the other. So I really welcome this book, and I am excited to welcome the author to The State of Belief, R.G. Cravens. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Paul. Happy to be here.
Let's go back a little ways and talk a little bit about where you come from. Like, what makes up RG, and how did you arrive at this point in your career where you're really offering, I think, some groundbreaking research and analysis, which I so appreciate, and we're going to get to that. But what's the myth behind the man?
I have been a student, really, of politics for most of my life. Prior to coming to SBLC, I was assistant professor of political science. So the idea of political behavior and sort of understanding how and why we engage in politics has always been interesting to me. Before going to graduate school, so after I'd finished my work in undergrad, I took some time to do organization work, political mobilization work, and voter registration and these kinds of things, working predominantly with LGBTQ plus folks, especially rural queer folks, were who I mostly stayed in contact with and helped to politically, right, organize and mobilize. And while doing that work, it occurred to me that there were lots of interesting aspects of LGBTQ identity that weren't being discussed academically, right? So things like how religion intersects with LGBTQ identity and how being in a rural place could influence politics and your ability to engage. And so those questions were really interesting to me personally, because I was sort of experiencing them and seeing them. But then, you know, also academically, professionally, I thought, you know, other people would benefit from knowing how faith specifically, right, affects LGBTQ politics. And so I went to grad school and decided that I would think about these things. My work largely focused on the political behavior of LGBTQ people. And then from that work, eventually, we got to this particular writing. So the book project eventually emerged.
Yeah, well, it's really exciting. And why don't you just start with the main thesis, which is that religion actually plays a significant role in a lot of LGBTQ people's lives. And it's often overlooked or minimized in kind of almost support of a different kind of narrative, or perhaps because, you know, those who study aren't sure how to approach it. I mean, I celebrate this as someone who is gay identified and a Baptist minister. I'm kind of like, oh, you know, we're not that strange, you know, but, you know, there are people right out there, you know, I mean, and actually a lot of people. And so I think this is really important. So what's the main thesis yeah that we can take away from this important book?
Well, I think the one thing that's so important for me to say now is that the idea that a person right can't be both LGBTQ and religious, that's a false construction. It's a political construction, largely, right? It's something that was sort of created to fuel political division. And so I think it's really important if you can right understand that, then it makes sense, right, that LGBTQ people are deeply influenced by faith. That faith, how we're socialized into it, right? Because if it's a part of the world that we live in, especially in American politics, that it makes sense that it would influence, right, how LGBTQ people engage. And there have been studies that recognize that. And the thing that I thought was sort of missing there, though, was that we largely looked at LGBTQ people and faith as sort of reacting to it, right? Like how especially conservative faith was mobilized against LGBTQ rights. And that's only half the story. Like, that's only part of the story. I don't even know that I would say half now that I'm thinking about it. But it's only part of the story. And so, you know, the idea, though, that LGBTQ people aren't religious has been really deeply ingrained in our understanding of who LGBTQ people are. And it's falsely so because it's political construction. And so the reality, though, right, is that faith is a big part of the lives of most LGBTQ people. And so understanding that is what I do in the book, right? Trying to describe as best I can the experiences of socialization, coming out, and how those things work to mobilize politics in terms of informing, you know, what we know about politics and our political opinions, but then also how we engage in politics.
I thought that was really an interesting aspect that, you know, for some people, you know, the coming out moment, which, you know, there isn't a moment. Often it's like it was for me. It's for many people. It's not like, aha, I'm out. But it's a process. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to leave your religion behind. It may mean that you make adjustments. But what you found that it's much more complicated than, now I know I'm LGBT identified, I'm going to leave all of that baggage behind. That's not actually what happens.
Right, exactly. So folks who were raised in faith traditions, more often than not, don't change their religious affiliation after coming out. I think that's important to say. There are reasons why a person might change their religious affiliation, right? So having experienced conflict, right, between your faith and your LGBTQ identity, largely brought about, I would argue, by negative experiences with socialization, having to do with, you know, being raised perhaps in an unaffirming religious tradition, and that can help instigate conflict. Those things can certainly lead a person to change their faith after coming out, but it's not the most common experience.
That's the interesting thing, is that, like, we lean into that narrative pretty much reflexively. Yeah. And instead, it's actually not always that way, especially if it's a community that gives space for mm-hmm. people to actually evolve within their own self-understanding and identity. The involvement can continue.
Yes, absolutely. Having, you know, being raised, being what I call socialized in the book, right? So all of these experiences that go into informing your social connections and who you know and what you know about yourself. That's sort of what I'm referring to, broadly speaking, as socialization. But having positive socializing experiences with religion, so being in an affirming tradition or being, you know, positively affirmed as LGBTQ by a faith leader or in religious community, makes it much less likely that you would change your faith tradition after coming out. So I think that's important, right, to say that aspect of it too, because they're, you know, we do get sort of dominantly, right, what I call, I think I mentioned it as in the book, is the will and grace paradigm is what I sort of refer to, where we get these dominant constructions of LGBTQ identity in popular media, right, where religion is often only talked about as a foil for LGBTQ life, and that's not it. That's not necessarily
it's all about. And from my own perspective, I was raised in a church that I didn't realize it at the time, but you know, it had a woman pastor. I never heard anything anti-gay from the pulpit. Now, actually, it's like a reconciling thing. But when I first got to New York, someone invited me to a church, and it was Judson Church in New York City, which is like has been a place of affirming. And they're like, you know, they were Baptist, like serious, like, you know, the preacher at that time, Howard Moody, was like very like Blood of Jesus Baptist. But they also were very welcoming and affirming. We put together AIDS kits for heroin users. And, you know, I mean, and I want to get into this because it actually elevated my game as far as social awareness. Like, not only could I go to church, but they gave me the inspiration to engage within society around that issue, but then also other issues about what a Christian should be engaging in the world. And I think that's something that you talk about too in this book.
Absolutely. You know, I think there's two things. One to say is that there's a sort of a spectrum of affirming faith experiences. That when we say affirming faith, right, it can be more or less affirming. So, you know, you may not just be talking about a statement of faith that allows LGBTQ people to be members of your congregation, for example, right? So I measure it in several different ways, actually, in the text. You know, whether it's attending a religious organization or religious community that affirms marriage equality or that allows openly LGBTQ ministers, right? But it can look different in different places. I think that's important to think about, right? So affirmation can come on a sort of spectrum, and you know, we need to think about what that means. But yes, in terms of what the effect is on political activity and on you know, engagement with your community, yes. Being an affirming, especially an affirming faith tradition, it enhances those things, right? Your ability to participate, your ability to engage, and not just politically speaking, but to understand, right, things like the importance of diversity and difference and pluralism, and it really enhances those things as well. And so, for a lot of reasons, I you know, argue that affirming faith traditions are an important component of American democracy.
Yeah. And from there, I went to Union Seminary, where I actually, my understanding of what like diversity meant, like was very expanded into race and other important signifiers of diversity that that I was growing and learning. And I had a lot of growing and learning too, but we all do in one way or the other. And when I was there, as a project for James Cone, who was this great professor of liberation theology, Black liberation theology, I went to a movement that you probably have heard of called Unity, which is like MCC, but it's a Black LGBT tradition. And I have to say, like, he was so into it because he was like, it was liberation. I mean, it was they were talking about liberation for themselves, but for other people. And it was very powerful. And I think that, you know, I just wanted to take time to talk also about how race intersects with this question of LGBT, because we often, because of Will and Grace and others, I'm not slamming them. You know, I mean, they did good work, but we often tend to like immediately go to white images when we talk about LGBTQ. And actually that's just part of the story. And it has to be always remembered. That's just part of the story. So when we're talking about religion and LGBTQ engagement, race and background play a huge part in the experience of it. How did you find that in your research?
Absolutely, and I'm glad you mentioned the Unity movement. I actually do. There's a shout out to Unity in the book. Looking at the different experiences, right? I mentioned that that affirmation is sort of a spectrum. LGBTQ affirmation is a sort of a spectrum of experiences. And I think that's true in terms of what that means practically for folks. So what I mean by that is that LGBTQ affirmation isn't like a perfect fix-all for the things that could be negative about religion. One thing that we that I did find, right, is that especially Black LGBTQ folks that I surveyed and had these open form answers for survey questions and tried to better understand the experiences of the folks I was surveying, but especially Black LGBTQ folks reported that they felt in LGBTQ spaces, predominantly LGBTQ spaces, they felt like religion was sort of looked down on. And so that was a thing to think about, right? It is how our inclusive spaces, spaces for LGBTQ folks, are not inclusive for everybody, right? And why that's the case. And so religion might be a way, right, in that is we construct LGBTQ spaces and we exclude religion. We might also be excluding others, not just based on religion, but because faith is important to different people in different ways, right? How those especially intersect with race, we could be excluding LGBTQ people of color from our spaces. So race does play an important role, right, in understanding affirmation. We have constructed another narrative, especially about the Black Protestant church, that is, right, is homophobic and difficult to for LGBTQ people. But I think it's important to say that Black people are no more homophobic than anybody else, first off, but that that we have to understand that when spaces, LGBTQ spaces are constructed for predominantly white people, that it can negatively affect LGBTQ people of color and their ability to benefit from those spaces. And I think that comes through in the research.
We're talking about this really important book. It's Yes, God, How Faith Shapes LGBT Identity and Politics in the United States. One thing I think is just important to remember for people who don't really like understand, especially LGBT people who are really like, religion has no place and religion, I understand people who have been traumatized and stuff like that. But the important thing is also for those who are in the spaces, it can be a source of joy and sustenance in a way that other spaces are not. And, you know, it's not only like a place that informs us and helps us be, you know, citizens and better activists and parts of our community, but it also can be personally nourishing in a world that is often hostile. And so I just think it's also worth mentioning that there are many spaces where these are important places for people to survive and to feel joy and things like that.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that's why it's so very important, right, to understand what it means to have affirming congregations and what it means to make sure those places are available. I, as part of my work with the Southern Poverty Law Center, one thing that I do track is attacks, threats against inclusive institutions, what I call of our civil society. So places like churches, schools, libraries, right? Things that are supposed to help make our society work for everybody. It's no coincidence that places like that, like LGBTQ affirming churches, are under attack. I think that's important to say, right? Because they do offer this inclusive aspirational, I think I call it in the book, vision for society, what we could be, what's the best thing for us, right, as a society. And that's under attack, that's under threat, because it does threaten those who would go back on our pluralistic values and those who would oppose inclusive multiracial democracy.
100%. Can you talk a little bit more about that research? Because it's so important what you're doing. You just had a report that I think is called Captain. Can you talk about that? And then there's just a lot of work that you, such important work. We're so grateful to you for lifting up this important work, because what you just said is so important. Like, this is a frontline issue for people who want to stop the expansion of who matters in our country. They're very threatened by that. And so they go after institutions like libraries, like affirming churches and other religious spaces, and like schools, where people might actually learn, okay, we can live side by side with people who are different than ourselves. And you've been really tracking these attacks. And it's just so valuable. So talk a little bit about various reports that you've been doing that can let us know what's really going on.
Yeah. So thanks for the opportunity to talk about these things as well. The first that you mentioned, CAPTAIN, that's an acronym that stands for Combating Anti-LGBTQ Pseudoscience Through Accessible Informative Narratives. And so what the point of that report is to look at how pseudoscience has been used to especially construct an anti-trans movement in the past several years, really geared towards doing just that, limiting, right, the ability of trans folks to participate in society and taking away access to things like healthcare and spaces in school, right? And to fuel not you know both policy and really in-person sort of violent attacks, right, against LGBTQ people. So one thing I think that it's important to say about that work here is that we know pseudoscience is a tool of white supremacy. It's been used for centuries, right, to create ways to artificially distinguish between who is deserving and undeserving, right, of things in society. But it's also, we show in this report, a tool of the contemporary religious right. It's a way to encode beliefs, especially divisive beliefs about people, using the cover of religion to encode those into our politics. And so we document in that report how the actors of the contemporary religious right, as some, many of your listeners probably know the term, but some 60 groups we found and more than 1,000 connections between them are part of this network to create pseudoscientific studies about, especially about trans people. And again, sort of using the language of science, taking those beliefs about that are largely informed through conservative religious doctrines and encode them into science and then encode that into our laws and into our policies.
It's so nefarious. I mean, because here you have like two things, have so much going on at once. These are the people who often just say, oh, we don't trust science on this. They're very anti-science on one side, but they're very eager to use the veneer of pseudoscience to reinforce bigotry, reinforce discrimination. And so like, they kind of make up what science is for them rather than actually do real science. And I'm sorry to feel like, I'm simplistic about this because I don't know that much, I'm not a scientist, but it feels very ironic that they're leaning into science, quote unquote, when they're the ones who always undermine science on everything else. And here they're doing science like that is pseudoscience, but they're using it as a reason, as a rationale. And I thank you for making that connection with the history of this. We've heard this before. And you're exactly right. Like science about everything under the sun, but it's pseudoscience and it's used always for bigotry. It's used always for discrimination. So thank you for like lifting that up. It's so important.
Yeah, there's as you said, right, a long history of this. It's not a new phenomenon. This is the latest. We call it the latest iteration, right, of this network. We've seen this happen before. Science to this to speak to your point, right? Science sort of makes sense when it confirms my beliefs. Is the underlying principle here, and that's that's not an accurate description of the scientific method or process,
right?
But it also is it's a strategy, right? It's a tool.
Right. We're not bigoted. We're just looking at the science.
Right.
And so,
the science.
Like, can you just get a little granular with that? Like, what's an example of something that they've put out there that the scientific community is like, wait, what are you doing?
Sure.
But they're putting it out there. Well, our study shows. And
right.
This is
so there's a couple of things. One that comes to mind is that the big goal of this network is to create doubt, to sow doubt in scientific consensus around especially gender affirming care. Gender affirming healthcare, it represents a global scientific consensus, right? Affirming LGBTQ healthcare is a global scientific consensus. And the idea is to sow doubt in that consensus.
Right.
And so it happens in a lot of ways, right? Sometimes it doesn't just get like a point doesn't just get asserted that says, oh, this is better than what you're talking about, right? Because often they can't say this is better than that because the alternative is not better. It's not scientifically sound. It's in fact against the consensus of medical providers. And so you don't often get like this one thing that's way better to say this is the best, the better option than affirming care, because that doesn't necessarily exist. The point is to sow doubt in gender affirming care. And so what that looks like, though, is that you do often get these really these pseudoscientific claims, right, that are based on really emotion, but as I mentioned, right, like religious beliefs to conservative, ultra-conservative religious beliefs. So one thing that comes to mind, this is a term that has been used. It's the notion of rapid onset gender dysphoria. It is one of these that happens through social contagion. And these sound like scientific things, right? But the underlying idea is that kids are sort of rapidly becoming transgender all of a sudden, and it happens in affirming environments. So it's a social contagion that's spread. It dehumanizes trans people. It makes it sound like trans people are not really people. It's just an ideology that gets shared and passed around, and that people are susceptible to it, and that certain people are more susceptible than others. And it's used then, if you think about it, right, if you agree to this false notion, right, that trans identity is adopted and passed around through contagion in affirming places, then the policy options available to you are to shut that transmission down, right, and to stop the talking about LGBTQ plus identities, to ban books about LGBTQ plus people, to limit curricula about LGBTQ plus people, to shut down hospitals and medical providers, right? It makes sense then. So you see that the pseudoscience of it, it really does perform these nefarious purposes later down the road in terms of setting up policy.
And you're right, it has policy implications, because like, oh my God, there's a contagion. We're gonna have to shut it down. Remember COVID, which we didn't believe in, but now we're gonna actually believe in this. Do you remember there was like some crazy, I don't remember what it was, but like, there's a school where someone is a cat and they have to have litter boxes. And like, you know, I mean, and that became truth for some people. Like that became a real thing that then became like, this is what we're talking about. This crazy contagion of people being anything that they decide. And they're all just so, you know, and then you just shut it down. You shut it down.
Up next, more with R.G. Cravens. You can hear full episodes of The State of Belief anytime on our website at stateofbelief.com. You'll also find links to topics we discussed this week, as well as transcripts and more. And make sure you subscribe at stateofbelief.com/subscribe. You're listening to The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet.
Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does, because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The State of Belief. I'm Interfaith Alliance President, Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. My guest is Dr. R.G. Cravens, author of the new book, Yes, God, How Faith Shapes LGBT Identity and Politics in the United States.
One of my like real is here you have all of these parents who have these children whom they love, who they're trying to care for the best they can. They love their kids, and they are trying to make their kids survive and thrive, and they're giving them care. And it's all with a doctor. None of it is willy-nilly because it's so intense and a lot. And everybody is trying the best they can. And to have it demeaned and undermined, and talk about governmental overreach into the family unit to be able to care for and love your child as you think is appropriate. It's outrageous. And a lot of this, the people who are always talk about government overreach and talk about family values, they don't care anything about it. When it comes to trans, especially trans youth and families of trans people who are trying the best they can to love their children.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to the broader point. She speaks to the idea that we can confidently stand up, and faith communities have a role to play in this, right? And we've talked about LGBTQ affirmation from faith communities and how important that is, right, to identity development and also to political development. But faith communities have a role. They can be confident in the idea that, you know, gender-affirming care, LGBTQ health care is a consensus, a global scientific consensus. And you know, they can affirm that. They can affirm the identities and beings, the humanity of LGBTQ plus people. And that's an important role for our faith communities and faith leaders to play.
It is really important. And it is, honestly, it isn't that hard to say that we welcome everyone, you know, and to, you know, invite people of all genders to our table. It does require, I'm not saying it doesn't require some intentionality, but we can all do this. We can do it. And it can be, it can honestly save someone's life.
Sure. And, you know, I think it's important to some of the other work that we've been looking into at SPLC, you know, deals with this notion again of the idea that saying that a person can't be both religious and LGBTQ is just false. It's not supported by the social scientific research that I've done. It's a political strategy, right? It's a political tactic, and that comes across in a lot of these reports that you're mentioning that we do. You know, in some cases we've had seen groups that will document like attacks on LGBTQ affirming churches, but in the same breath, right, in public comments about these documents that they've put together, they'll say and blame LGBTQ people for attacks on Christians, as if LGBTQ people can't be Christian. And you know, I think those are things that we can that especially Interfaith Alliance, right, can push back on, right, and say that as you said, right, it's not that hard to affirm that LGBTQ folks can do exist, can be part and are part of our faith communities and have a very long history. That's sort of the next project for me, is to examine more of that history of LGBTQ religious and political mobilization, and look back on that. And you know, we can confidently say that you know, LGBTQ religious folks have been around for a long, long time. You know, Interfaith Alliance and your work does give us that example and hope, right, that they will continue to be there, and faith communities, interfaith communities, will continue to support them.
Churches have actually been locations where some activism has taken place. I mean, if we look at something like PFLAG, that was, you know, made its start in a Methodist church basement. And I know in, like, you know, a church close to us, me here in New York, at Holy Apostles Church, you know, ACT UP was meeting. I mean, there were people who were in the Stonewall, there were people who were protesting early on who were given space. And it's just important. It is important for all of us to remember the power. And the power that it has. One of our affiliates is in Fresno, California, and a Lutheran church out there that is very open about their welcoming and affirming stance, and has been super visible. Well, they had one of these fundraisers for LGBT youth, and they had all of their windows broken in. And the Proud Boys actually left their card. I mean, they were very happy to claim it. And then, you know, you brought this upon yourself. you've done some reporting on this too. Like, this is outrageous. It's like, you know, I mean, it's akin, it's not the same, but it's akin to churches that have been attacked for flying a Black Lives Matter banner or something like that. For their own testimony, their religious testimony about what they truly believe, and they're being attacked for it. And instead of saying, oh, we stand up for freedom of religion, we stand up for everybody's right to believe as they wish and to express that belief, they say, well, you know, of course this happened to you. Look at what you're shoving it in our faces.
Yeah, I think there's really so two things that come to mind to say. And one is that, again, there's no coincidence that spaces that affirm LGBTQ people, that are part of our civil society, the things that make our democratic, multiracial democracy work, those places are under attack. Especially by far right activists who, you know, you mentioned one group, there are others, right, that we've tracked and documented. It's no coincidence that those are the places that are under attack, the things that help make our society work. And then two, that those attacks, interestingly enough, we found get used by other groups that are part of the far right anti-LGBTQ movement to sort of bolster their case, right, that Christians and the Christian churches especially are under attack, and then they'll blame those attacks on other things like trans people, for example. It's just really a cycle, right, where the violence gets perpetuated by the environments created by these groups who claim that, you know, they're actually under attack and not affirming and accepting institutions of our civil society. And so it's really this terrible feedback loop that happens. Right. And so, you know, I'm sorry to hear about that.
I don't use it as a special example. I use it as a case in point, you know, I mean, yeah. It really speaks into what you're doing. And, you know, I think one of the hopeful things as part of your book was the using this idea of what it means to have include LGBTQ religious spaces as part of a response to white Christian nationalism that we're seeing. I mean, obviously the Interfaith Alliance does a lot with this, and we're really concerned about, you know, we're concerned with religion and democracy, and we believe that religion has a role to play in democracy, that we welcome that role. We actually celebrate it, but we also see people weaponizing religion in order, frankly, to curtail democracy and to gain power. But you offer this idea of, like, actually, we might find one of the inspirations for a counter movement can be found in some of these religious spaces that are welcoming of LGBTQ people with an eye towards a wider understanding of what America is meant to be and represent.
Yeah, I think that's important to think about for sure. You know, I've written about this in the book and other places too. The idea that LGBTQ faith can be a sort of template for political resistance, right, to white Christian nationalism especially. You know, the idea again is that because white Christian nationalism, we're talking about a political movement, right, a movement designed to create barriers of division. And to establish boundaries around what it means to be truly an American, right? And that you say that certain other people can't be American. What that does is it creates this and reinforces this false notion that LGBTQ people can't be religious, that they can't be Christian, and thereby can't be American either, right? And are entitled to the benefits of American society. And so, you know, it's really a deep divisive anti-democratic perspective. And so what the history of LGBTQ faith and LGBTQ affirming faith has shown us, and this is the lessons that come from this, are that inclusive, non-coercive faith, like I saw in documented in my book, those things can be templates for moving ahead, to push back against the forces that would deny pluralism, right? To allow for a more inclusive and accepting society where faith communities can empower folks to engage in politics in productive and inclusive ways. And I think that's really, you know, a good lesson to think about is deconstructing that political notion of division, that you know, the way that faith is used to divide, that In short, the LGBTQ plus affirming faith traditions that I look at and that come across in the book are standing adamantly against that notion. Not that they're perfect, right? Not that they're the perfect solution.
Of course not.
But they do stand against that notion of division in really important ways and authoritarianism, right, that are trying to take those things and those inclusive parts of our civil society away from us.
Yeah, and you know what they want is a very clean sense of who matters, right, which they could boil down to Christian, white, men and women who agree that men should be in charge. you know, it's a very sort of constructed idea of who matters and who gets to. And when we have things that complicate that and expand that, that's very threatening. And yet that's America. I am sorry. That is, I mean, you know, and so how do we, you know, I think what's an important part for Interfaith Alliance is not to feel like we're just combating something else. We're casting a vision for an expansive idea of who matters and who can be a part of constructing that society, and who can we bring along from all these different faith traditions, as well as secular and humanist and atheist. How can we all construct where we matter, especially under the law, where we matter equally? And have full rights. And I think that's very threatening to the Christian nationalist idea.
I think you really helped to put into focus one of the lessons from the book, and that's the way that faith, and I think I call it this idea of being a facilitator, but also a catalyst for politics, and how LGBTQ affirming faith, it is a way for folks to what I call a catalyst. I talked to some, or had some folks, the responses was showing that their encounter with affirming faith was a way for them to sort of see for the first time what, you know, truly inclusive politics could look like, and give them that vision. And that was really important, right? That catalyst. But faith was also a facilitator in the way that you mentioned previously, earlier in our conversation, about how, faith communities would gather and go to pride marches or rallies, or would, you know, help to put folks in contact with elected officials, or would provide some impetus for engaging in politics in constructive ways. I think those are all true, and they come across in the lessons of the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's really it's exciting, and you know, just my sense of just how important it is for sometimes, you know what, I don't, like, I'm a Baptist minister, but I honestly, you know, I'm the type of Baptist minister who is totally fine with you not being a Baptist or not being a Christian at all. It's fine. My job is to love you actually as you are, whatever religion, whatever. But I think sometimes it is, like, it's actually kind of tragically moving, but important, when I show up and people who have really been hurt by religion say, oh, wow, there is a space where that wasn't the only vision of what Christianity was. And so, like, they're not trying to join a church. They're done with that. But they feel somehow there's a space for them in the religious spiritual world, which might open up into some other exploration of, you know, whatever tradition they may eventually go into. But I think it's just important, you know, for those of us who are within religious traditions to be really open about how this is part of what we believe in. And it's not like, you know, it's just part of what is our faith, and we believe it because of our faith rather than in spite of our faith.
I think that's very well said. Very well said. I don't want to miss the point of part of the book too, right? Was understanding how this happens, that LGBTQ people feel alienated by faith and by religion. And I think it's really important, right? About a quarter of the folks that I surveyed in different methods, a quarter of them experienced faith and LGBTQ identity conflict. They felt conflicted about their faith and LGBTQ identity. And a significant proportion, right? That's a large proportion of folks. So it's important to recognize that faith has been used as a tool wielded against LGBTQ
100%.
People. And we have to reckon with that. We have to understand and try our best to deal with that.
I want to just say like on air, I want to say thank you for referencing us in some of the, you know, some of the ways you have recently. You've done a shout out to Interfaith Alliance as an example of a group that is, you know, not necessarily an LGBT group, but is really inclusive in this. And that just, it means a lot to us, because like no one necessarily is saying you guys should do this. We're doing it because we feel like it's part of what matters in our faith work and our democracy work. And, you know, and my predecessor, Two Back, was this straight white Southern Baptist, Welton Gaddy, I'm going to invoke his name, who just got this in his heart. And he, you know, and he was just like, I'm going to speak up for this, and I don't care what I lose, because it's right. And I just think that I really appreciate being seen by researchers like you. And I just appreciate the partnership with Southern Poverty Law Center. And we're just like, really, I feel like we're just beginning to explore what that can look like, because we are very aligned in many ways about imagining the future of America that doesn't involve hate. I really appreciate
absolutely
it.
Yeah, and the same for me. I really do thank you for you know, this opportunity and for working together. I look forward to it.
Excellent. So I always end with everybody asking them what gives you hope in this time, which for a lot of people is very grim, but I'm going to ask you, RG, what is giving you hope right now?
Well, you know, I think we've already talked about this. This conversation that we're having, you know, very often goes in a really negative way, right? And by that, I mean, it just focuses on the negative, because that's so often the story that we hear about religion and LGBTQ life is negative. It's there's conflict. There's a culture war. Literally, we've come up with these terms, right, to put these two things at odds with one another, like there can never be reconciliation, like they must always stand apart. And so this conversation so frequently follows that narrative, and I'm very hopeful, you know, because we've spent so much time not necessarily talking about that, right? That frames part of our conversation. Obviously it has to, it's just, but also we've talked about and explored and understood, right, that faith and LGBTQ identity are full of diversity and it's full of difference, and that difference makes us strong, and recognizing that and building on that and finding opportunities to collaborate and really hold America to its pluralistic ethos, I think is what gives me hope in this time now, because I see it happening. I know it's happening, but being able to put some perspective to it from a social scientific light, and then also in the work that bringing that social science into the examination of things like we're seeing happening in the far right through SVLC, all of those things working together, I think, do give me hope in collaboration with these kinds of partnerships with you all in your organization.
Dr. Royal G. Cravens III, also known as RG,
is Senior Research Analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
The author of several incredibly important recent reports, he is the previous recipient of the Bailey and Cynthia Weber Award from the American Political Science Association, and has held fellowships with the Social Science Research Council and Public Religion Research Institute. RG has also just released a new book titled Yes, God: How Faith Shapes LGBT Identity and Politics in the United States. RG, thank you so much for being with us today on The State of Belief.
Thanks, Paul. Great to be here.
Please be sure to subscribe to The State of Belief at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform, or at stateofbelief.com/subscribe. We need your help to keep making The State of Belief. Become a partner in this crucial work with a financial contribution today. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And share what you're getting out of this show with the people in your networks. Let's get more people listening and keep these conversations going on Facebook and Instagram at the handle @stateofbelief. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Religion News Service or Religion News Foundation. The State of Belief is produced by Ray Kirstein and is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week. I'll be joined by Sky Perryman, the president of Democracy Forward, and we're going to be talking about all the things that are happening to abortion rights and freedom in this country. I can't wait. Until then, I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch on The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet.